Thanks so much for joining us today on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here. And you know, we can't safely participate in things like group or team sports right now. Gyms, they come with some risk. There are still several sports and outdoor activities, however, to choose from. And our physical therapists are back with us today to talk about some of our options, how to get started, and even to tackle some common injuries you might have with these activities. Jill Tide-Nissenbaum and Lori Tyne-Brody on the phone with us. Jill's an associate professor in the Doctor of Physical Therapy program at UW-Madison. Jill, good to have you with us.
Hi, Larry. Great to hear you.
Yeah, good to hear your voice. Lori Tyne-Brody, physical therapist and athletic trainer at UW Health Spine Physical Therapy Clinic. And Lori, good to have you with us.
Good to be here.
Well, as you listen to these two experts, have you been able to get out there and get some exercise? Maybe you have some questions or concerns about sports like running or biking or pickleball, tennis, golf, whatever. Do you have any other questions for our physical therapists? You can join in the conversation. Give a call, 800-642-1234, or email us at ideas@wpr.org. Love to hear from you. You know, the weather has been pretty nice, at least in southern Wisconsin. Unfortunately, we still need to think about social distancing and safety, so group and team sports certainly risky. But there are plenty of other activities suitable for a couple of people. And it seems to me, at least in my jogs around the neighborhood and on the golf course, we've seen a lot of activity and a lot of people getting some exercise outside. Jill, what do you have you been seeing a lot of people out there exercising?
I have. We live very close to a conservancy, so there's lots of people out walking and biking and making really good choices about maintaining their social distance while they're doing that. But there are other options besides walking and biking where you can maintain social distance. And in Wisconsin, in the summertime, you want to get out and do those things as much as you can. So I think we mentioned earlier other options such as tennis and pickleball and stand-up paddleboarding and canoeing and kayaking as all really good options where you can get out and enjoy Wisconsin in the summertime while respecting that social distancing.
Yeah, I think so as well. Lori, you agree?
Yeah, absolutely. And I feel like I've seen more people out and about, but, you know, I don't know if it's just because I'm home more.
Right, exactly.
Maybe those people were there the whole time. So, but it's good to see people getting out, walking their dogs, you know, riding their bikes, just getting exercise on a daily basis. And, you know, one of the questions that comes up is, you know, do you need to maintain a social distance? And do you need to wear a mask if you're outside? And those are important questions to consider when you are going outside to exercise.
Yeah, but it is difficult if you're exercising to wear the mask. I know it's hard to
right.
do.
Right. Well, if you're doing something where you're breathing really hard, certainly a mask is going to be problematic, you know, and if you're wearing sunglasses and they fog up and, you know, with someone who wears a mask for much of my day, I can tell you those are certainly important issues. But, you know, if you are, for example, going for a walk with members of your own household, you don't need to wear a mask. You're not masking at home. But if you're going to be out and about and where you're going to encounter other people and it may be crowded, and I would certainly encourage people to try to get out at times and in places where it's not crowded. But we are seeing, you know, some of the trails and things fairly crowded. So you may want to have a mask. Or I think another easy solution is to carry a bandana, and if you are going to pass somebody, you can simply put that bandana over your nose and mouth as you pass them.
I see a lot of people out walking in the conservancy where I live that do that exactly what Lori had mentioned. They have the bandana kind of loosely tied around their neck, and as they come within 6 or 10 feet of passing someone, they just bring it up over their nose, wave politely, move on, and then put it back down once they're in kind of a free space again. So that's a really nice option if you can't get out during the less crowded times.
Yeah. Lori Tyne Brody, Jill Tyne Nissenbaum, our guest today as we talk with them about those outdoor activities where you can get a little physical work in and have some fun in the out of doors. Well, you know, tennis and pickleball, frankly, I compare them to golf, for example, where I pick up my own ball.
Mm-hmm. Correct.
And I even with a foursome, it's very easy to maintain. And if you're walking, it's a, 6-7 mile walk pushing a 40-pound bag around. That's pretty good exercise to me, and I don't have to share a ball. But what about tennis and pickleball? That's fairly low risk, I suppose.
Both tennis and pickleball are considered low risk. The only thing that can get a little questionable is doubles pickleball because the court is smaller than a tennis court. So if you're both up towards the net, you may be a little bit closer than 6 feet to one another. But if your pickleball partner is, for example, your spouse or someone you live with, I don't consider that a concern. You don't need to wear a mask if you've been exposed to that person all along. Touching the pickleball itself, it probably may bring a very, very low risk. But, as long as you both have good hand washing techniques, or all four of you have good hand washing techniques, and you're using hand sanitizer before the pickleball event, and hand sanitize again afterwards, I would say the risk is minimal. You're never going to be what we would consider zero risk at this point. So you have to consider those things as very, very low risk. So I would put that in the very low risk category. What about you, Lori?
Yeah, I would agree with that as well. And you just have to be careful not to touch your face during that match. Sometimes you wipe your sweat or something like that. You have to be careful not to do that with your hand if you're picking up the ball. That's the one thing that I would say.
Right. So that would be another good time to use like a bandana or have a handkerchief or something in your pocket so you can wipe your sweat with that. And that way you can keep the sweat out of your eyes, but again, you're not putting your hand to your face.
Got the kayaks out the other day, too, and canoeing and kayaking are really good exercises as well. And frankly, kayaking, pretty much you're all by yourself unless you have a two-person kayak, but most people don't.
Right. It's a great option, as is stand-up paddleboarding. So you can be out with someone, but you're maintaining that social distance and enjoying Wisconsin nature. So that's a great strategy. So stand-up paddleboarding, kayaking, those are great outdoor water-based activities that present really low risk.
Right. The only time that is risky really is when you're launching. So if there's a whole bunch of people on a beautiful day that have the same idea and show up at the same place to launch their kayak or whatever, then you just have to be careful. You have to use those same considerations that you would use any place else. So those are the times when I would wear a face covering and I would maintain 6 foot distance and so on. And you use common sense.
Well, lots of people online with questions and comments, so we can flip back and forth to some of these other exercises as we move along, and they may come up as part of questions. Gary in Eau Claire with us first. Gary, thank you for calling.
Hi. I'd like to thank the two sisters for their PT advice about a year ago when I contacted them. I'd been to therapy twice for biceps tendonitis and all the impingement that goes on. And I went back for a third time and stressed that I didn't want to use bands, but to use weights if there was any strengthening. And things turned around pretty fast. That was a year ago in March.
Oh,
and I was
great.
We were looking at surgery last November, and things are very good.
Oh, that's so good. Yeah, I'm not a huge fan of bands in that case, particularly for that that problem. So there are some things where bands work pretty well, but I don't think that's one of them.
Yeah, with long levers, you have to be very careful.
Well, it's always good to hear your advice results in a good outcome. Thank you,
exactly.
Gary. Thanks for calling, Gary. Well, Amy in Weston, your turn. Hi, Amy.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. Well, I had an injury in January. It was a snowshoeing injury. I fell off a bank. It wasn't big, but I kept walking. I'm like, boy, this ground is so uneven. Well, I was walking with only one snowshoe. And from that, I know, I'm sure you've heard many things, but I'm coming clean to everybody on the airwaves. So I have, I guess, hip bursitis.
Yes.
I saw a PT probably a month into it, probably went for over a month, did my exercises. Then COVID came up. And basically, I have to say, I don't feel I'm getting better. I'm still there. So this is like 4 months later. I do my exercises probably once a day. I probably ice on average once a day as well. So my questions are, what can I do to get better? And what can I do to perhaps strengthen myself so it doesn't happen again?
Well, I guess my first question is, do we really think this is coming from your hip, or do we think this could be a referral pattern from your low back? That's kind of my first thought, Lori, if you're doing exercises and not getting better. So maybe we should back
right.
up and tell us what kind of exercises you're doing.
Okay, I'm doing a standing hip flexor stretch.
Okay.
I'm doing like a warrior pose. I'm doing an IT band stretch against the wall where I lean into the wall, where my one leg is in front, and then
yep.
I lean in the opposite direction with the other leg in back. And then if I'm saying this right, the piriformis stretch.
Yep.
So I'm doing those things, and I would say, you know, my lower back, if I'm sitting watching TV at night, it is tough. It does hurt then. I don't really feel it, during the day, but it's just when I'm sitting. And I guess the other thing, after this injury happened, I really didn't stop doing anything physical. I kept doing cross country skiing, more snowshoeing, but with both of them. And, so I don't know if I kind of, you know, escalated it by not giving it time to heal. But anyway, I'm just very surprised that I'm still at this point where I'm still feeling it every day.
Yeah.
And especially at night, I'm just laying in bed.
Yeah. So, yeah, the whole laying in bed and having pain at night, if it's a primary hip problem, it shouldn't bother you so much at night. Have you had any imaging?
No, I have not.
And when it bothers you at night, where does it hurt?
If I were to look at my hip bone, like the top part of the femur, if I were to do like a bullseye around that bony point, that's where it hurts the most. And it probably hurts also like on that lower bony point as well. But really the top of my hip is where I feel it the most. I mean, sometimes I do feel like the IT band, but usually I can massage that, and that's not as tough, but the top part of my hip, for sure.
So I don't know what you mean by the top part of your hip. Where are you? Is it on the side, on the back, in the front?
I think she means her bursa.
It would be on my side. Like when I touch like the top of my bone on my hip, if I were just...
Yeah.
Do like a circle around that. It really is. That's the most painful point.
So is it painful when you sleep at night or when you lay down at night? Are you laying on it or are you laying on the opposite side or are you laying on your back?
I'm laying on my back for the most part.
Okay. So that doesn't make sense.
Yeah, that doesn't make sense either. So, you know, what we're looking at is the on that outside of your hip and that bony prominence on your femur, that's there's a bursa there, a trochanteric bursa, and sometimes people get a bursitis there. You know, that's the most common thing that hurts right in that spot, but it shouldn't bother you at night when you're laying on your back, theoretically.
And the other thing is, although your program that you described to us has a lot of flexibility in it, which is wonderful, and that's typically where we start,
But I'm wondering if, you know, you said COVID had hit. I'm wondering if your therapist, the next thought was, oh, we need to do a lot of strengthening, and we just didn't get there. So my thought would be, if you feel comfortable, I would go back to my physical therapist. I think, you know, the flexibility was a good place to start. There's no strengthening here. So if it is coming from your hip, number one, I think you need some strengthening exercises now. And number two, I would still feel more comfortable ruling it out just to make sure that this isn't coming from your back and this isn't more a spine-related condition that could still be treated by physical therapy. But I'm wondering if, you know, you had more than one thing going on with this.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, so, you know, pain in your hips at night, and unless you're lying on that side.
Or so, yeah.
Yeah, we tend to look towards the back for that. So, one of the most common areas that's hard to really sort out is the back hip connection, because the symptoms, that if you think about it as a Venn diagram, there's a lot of overlap between primary back problems and primary hip problems. And then the corollary to that is, we often assume when someone has pain that there's a single source for that pain.
Right.
Then it could certainly, both of them can be contributors.
Right.
And so they really address the hip, but maybe they need to address the back as well. But it needs to get sorted out, because it shouldn't be going on this long. Yeah.
Good luck, Amy. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. Jill Tine Nissenbaum, Lori Tine Brody, our guest today. I'm Larry Mueller. Natalie Guyette, our producer. Tyler Ditter, our engineer. And you are listening to the Ideas Network. Great to have you along today on the Ideas Network, taking a look at physical therapy, outdoor activities, and all those aches and pains and sprains and strains that can happen while we're either indoors or outdoors, for that matter. Lori Tine Brody, Jill Tine Nissenbaum, both from the UW-Madison. It's great to have them with us today. And we'll take another call right now. Darlene in Green Bay has something for us. Let's go there. Hi, Darlene.
Hi there. Thank you for taking my call. I'm calling about an adult daughter's right shoulder. She has played a lot of softball in her life from about 6 till almost like last year. She teaches mathematics and does a lot of teaching using a whiteboard. And when she has her arm up there writing problems and whatnot, she has a lot of pain, so much so that she has to put her arm down for a second and then start up again. I don't know. She claims that about maybe 7-8 years ago, she was playing softball in October and feels that for the second game, she did not warm up her arm good enough. And she said she seems to have pulled something then, and it has continued, I believe, to get worse.
Was she a pitcher by any chance?
No, but she throws one heck of a strong ball.
Okay.
From third base, for sure.
Okay. Yeah, it's a long throw.
May I ask how old your daughter is?
She's 44.
Okay. All right. Yeah, I mean, the symptoms that you are describing are fairly classic rotator cuff. So whether she strained her rotator cuff when she didn't warm up that game, and now just the constant overhead work is perpetuating the problem, it sounds like a rotator cuff or impingement syndrome. Jill, what do you think?
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, with that writing on the whiteboard, that's a lot of kind of arm abducted to 90 degrees or overhead prolonged positioning. And if she has some rotator cuff irritation or weakness, that would definitely exacerbate it. So that makes sense. It was probably time for her to see a physical therapist. She's been dealing with this for a long time, and we want to keep her working and teaching for sure.
That's right.
Yeah.
And particularly now when she's not having to write, would be my guess. This would be the time to deal with it. Sometimes it's really hard to get these problems better when your work requires you to get in a position or do an activity that really aggravates your problem. So for
what
people
kinds
with...
of, I was going to ask, what kinds of activities would normally be done to improve this?
Great question. So it would be, we would start with an examination and see if there are any particular positions, postures, or movements that aggravate it. And then we would work around that. So Jill.
Right. So there may be things where she's has a lack of mobility or doesn't have good scapular control. So many times it starts with strengthening muscles that are more in the back to make sure that her scapula or shoulder blade can move appropriately, and then getting that going. And then once that's going okay, then it's making sure that she's using her rotator cuff muscles appropriately, not overusing, for example, her upper trapezius muscle. Some people like to hike their shoulder to get their arm overhead. So it's all about making sure that the muscles are working in concert together to get that shoulder blade to kind of rotate up and make sure that the ball sits okay in the socket joint, if you will.
Yeah. And we, you know, we screen for things like underlying hypermobility. So
right.
If she has some underlying hypermobility, which she may have as being a lifelong pitcher, then the focus of the exercises would be more towards stabilization. We may need to train her how to stabilize her shoulder when it's in an overhead position. On the flip side, she could have some stiffness in her shoulder because she stopped using it because it hurt and created these faulty movement patterns, as Jill described, and then we would work on some specific mobility exercises. So it really varies depending upon what we see on the examination. So not all rotator cuff problems are treated the same way.
All right. Darlene, thank you for calling. Charles in Madison, it's your turn. Hi, Charles.
Well,
hi,
hello.
Charles. What's on your mind?
Yeah. Okay. A quick question. Well, I woke up one morning and my thumb was a little achy. I'm 79 years old. And it pops at the joint whenever I bend it. There's a little bit of pain there.
Did you say toe?
Thumb.
Thumb.
Oh, thumb. Okay.
Thumb.
Okay. It was a little bit fuzzy there on the call.
So is it painful when it pops, Charles, or do you just hear a kind of a clicking noise?
A little bit of pain, but it clicks.
Okay. So is it kind of down closer? Where exactly in your thumb is it, I guess? That's my question. Which joint? Is it kind of right by the nail bed or...
Yeah, the nail bed, right at the joint.
Right at the joint. Okay. Well, the thumb is provides us about 70% of our hand function. So our thumb is used a lot. And there is a joint called your carpometacarpal joint of your thumb that is one of the most common places in the upper extremity to get arthritis. It's a saddle joint, so we use it a little bit differently, and that's what provides us so much mobility at our thumb. So I'm wondering if that's probably part of it, if there's a little bit of arthritis in Charles's thumb and we're getting a little bit of painful clicking at that joint. That'd be my guess. What do you think, Lori?
Yeah, I agree as well. And it may be that, you know, he could have arthritis farther down. It's somewhat the base of your thumb is one of the most common sites of arthritis. And if you're having some soreness or stiffness or loss of motion there, you may be overcompensating farther down. So it may be that other joint in your thumb is having to do extra work because some of the previous or the joints closer to your wrist are not able to move like they should. So that would be my guess. So have you had this before? Is this new?
No, it's brand new.
And did you do anything? Did you do anything different the last few days?
No, I think we may have lost Charles there.
Okay, all right. So sometimes things like that, if you have some underlying arthritis, they'll flare. If you've been doing too much, like if he's been outside doing more gardening or weeding or outside activity because it's been so nice out, sometimes it'll just flare up that joint. So you know, using some ice in the area, if it's safe to take, an anti-inflammatory, sometimes that will help calm that joint down. If you have any question on that, you should check with your doctor or pharmacist.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely. Good. Yep.
Yeah.
Good luck, Charles. Thanks very much for calling. You can join in too. The number to call, 1-800-642-1234, 800-642-1234, or you can email us at ideas@wpr.org. Bob in Sparta, it's your turn. Hi, Bob.
Hey, how you doing, guys? I need help.
Okay.
I've had three hips replaced. The last one was back in 2010. I always have mid-thigh pain in the right hip. The doctor has looked at it. He thinks that the stem of the hip, the implant, is pistoning. The only way they can do anything about that is to go back in, but he can't guarantee I'll be able to do what I am doing now for work and stuff. Recently, like back in October now, the front of my thighs, like from my stomach down to about the midpoint of my thighs, it feels like my muscles are really constricting. They're tight. I walk like I'm a gorilla.
Oh, man.
They've went and looked at it, and they look like they've done bone density tests.
Okay.
And they said the implants all look like they are good. But my muscles are just so tight, and I get so winded just by walking because my muscles are always constricting. You know what I mean? I'm at a loss.
So yes. When you say you walk like a gorilla, do you mean you really kind of shift your weight side to side when you walk? Is that what you're referring to?
Side to side. Yeah.
Okay. So, and you had three hip replacements all in the same hip?
No, two in the right, one in the left.
Okay. Okay. Is one worse than the other?
I'd say the right is worse, yeah.
Okay. What do you do?
The one that they had the revision in. So
yep.
They just
right.
took out half of it. They didn't replace the whole thing. They just took out half of it.
Okay. What do you do for a living or what do you do for work?
I drive a truck, local delivery. I'm in and out of the truck and trailer all the time.
Oh, God. Are you carrying Are you carrying packages, things like that?
Not packages. All my freight is usually on pallets, but I do have to wheel the pallets like to the back of the trailer a lot.
Oh, God.
Some of them can be 2,000 pounds. Some of them are lighter.
So,
and unfortunately, I've got to keep working for at least 10 more years, so I can't retire yet.
Oh, my God. All right. So,
no,
I assume you.
What do I do?
I assume you.
10 seconds or less. What are we doing?
Exactly. So, I assume you've been to therapy.
I haven't been to therapy since I've had the surgeries.
Okay. Well, it might be time to try that. So what's his sense? Why does he think it's pistoning if there's no change in your bone density? What's
in the x-ray where the right hip, the stem, there's a calcium buildup around where the tip of the stem is, and that's why he figures it's pistoning and the bone is building up because of that.
Right.
Doesn't feel like it's going to come apart or anything like that, but it just... I was taking 8 to 10 Advils a day. I mean, to try to keep up with the pain, and I can't do that all the time, you know.
Yeah. So you're still having pain in addition to this muscle tightness.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Oh my God. Okay. Yeah. Can we solve this in 30 seconds or less? So
yeah.
I guess what I would say is, I guess if it were me, I would do two things. One is I'd get back to therapy and see if they can help you by any targeted strengthening. That'd be one, see if they can help you with your gait, with how you move and how you use your muscles to see if they can do some retraining. And then the thing I'd do is I might talk with another surgeon, not in the same group, and see if there's any other options. Because you have a long time to go. For me personally, I'm what I consider a data collector. Like, I like to get information from a lot of different sources and sort of triangulate that and see if they all tell me the same thing, then I know where I'm at. But I also like to see if there's anything else out there. So, you know, you may talk to somebody else and see if there's any new information on strategies to deal with this kind of a problem. But I would also get into therapy because it's been 20 years. And your body has changed in that 20 years, see if there's any particular activities, whether it's gait or strengthening or stretching, that may help with your symptoms.
Yeah, good luck, Bob. Thank you very much.
That's a tough one, man.
That's very tough.
Yeah. Yeah.
Tom in Kenosha probably has a different problem. Let's go there. Hi, Tom.
Hi. Hey, calling about knee pain that I've had for about 3-4 years. I called the show maybe 6 months ago, and you guys recommended like eccentric exercises.
Yep.
Because I've had an MRI and an X-ray, both look perfect. Basically, the doctor says, you know, it's softening of the patella. And so I guess my next thing to try was the hyaluronic acid injection, like a gel injection.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
That's kind of where I'm at with it.
Have you done PT? I mean, we talked about the eccentric. Okay. So your MRI is clean. It doesn't show any arthritic changes or anything like that?
No.
Okay. So then I would definitely try, before you went down the path of hyaluronic acid injections, I would definitely try physical therapy, because I don't know that if there's anything that looks questionable in your joint, if the hyaluronic acid injections would be worthwhile. Would you agree, Lori?
I would agree with that. Has someone recommended that to you? Has the physician who did your imaging recommended that?
I kind of presented the idea to them, and they said that it's worth a try.
Okay. Because typically those injections are for people with mild to moderate arthritis on imaging who are having symptoms. I don't know if you fall into that category or not. It didn't sound like it based upon how you explain the results of your imaging.
You know what's interesting is, so the images look good, but you know what really kind of alleviates some symptoms is when I pinch my patella with my fingers and I kind of pull it away from the knee.
Oh, great. We got something for you.
Yeah.
Okay.
It's called a plunger. Yeah. So it sounds to me like you feel best when you unload or relieve the pressure on the undersurface or the backside of your kneecap or your patella.
Yeah.
And so there's some patellar compression going on there. So I think seeing a physical therapist would be very worthwhile. You may be compressing too much because you might have some tightness in your quadriceps muscles that's causing that compression. Your patella may not be tracking appropriately. The canoe needs to go up and down the river. That's the analogy I give appropriately. You don't want to bang into the banks on the side of the river or bang into your femur. And there actually is a plunger that you can purchase. It's very inexpensive, that creates some suction, and you can actually pull your patella up or kind of mobilize it to relieve that undersurface pressure. Your physical therapist can show you how to do that and kind of guide you through the purchasing of it. They're very inexpensive, and that can give you some good relief as well.
Are they called plungers?
Well, here's the long and short of it. It's a plunger that you would not use anywhere but your knee, and they're very similar to a sink plunger that you can buy at like a hardware store. But I personally have a hard time getting those hardware store plungers to work. The rubber's a little too stiff. So there's actually some that you can purchase from a place that's called the Institute of Physical Art, or IPA, not to be confused with the IPA you consume. So it's the Institute of Physical Art. And I believe they're $7 or $8. They're quite inexpensive, and they work great. You need to use some sort of sealant around it. We use ultrasound gel in the clinic, but I think, Lori, you said that
petroleum jelly.
Petroleum jelly or Aquaphor, something along those lines, seems to work quite well as well.
Yeah. And if your kneecap is having trouble tracking, as Jill said, there's also taping techniques that your physical therapist can try with you to help improve the tracking of that patella. And that can be tremendously helpful for people.
There you go, Tom. Good luck. Thank you so much for calling. Steve in Eau Claire, your turn. Hi, Steve.
Good morning, Larry. Good morning, ladies. I have a question about the ball of my right foot, the large pad behind my big toe, is very sensitive when I first arise in the morning. And I step on it, and we have hardwood floors, and there's a lot of pain that goes along with it. If I walk on it for a while, it seems to lessen. If I go onto a soft surface, it will lessen. And I notice it occasionally in my left foot, not to the same degree at all, but the right foot is particularly painful. I am a 69-year-old guy and a fairly active lifestyle. I'm wondering if you have any observations for me.
Yeah.
Well, it's either sesamoiditis or plantar fasciitis. Would you say, Lori?
Yeah. Yeah. I would say if it hurts right underneath the ball of your foot, I don't know if you have, there could be a little bit of OA in that first joint, but yeah. So there's two little bones. Little sesamoid bones. So your kneecap is a sesamoid bone. It's the biggest one in your body, and that is a bone that's attached only by tendons or ligaments and soft tissue. They're free floating. So there's two little sesamoid bones underneath the that first joint of your big toe. So you could have some inflammation of those little sesamoid bones. So as Jill said, sesamoiditis. Mm-hmm. It could be some plantar fasciitis, although it doesn't usually manifest there.
Right.
But I also wonder if you have some arthritis in that first toe joint. What happens as the day goes on? Does it get better?
If I quit moving for a while, it will seem to kind of come back again. As long as I keep it kind of moving and all around that, it's good. But I don't know if I expressed it well. It's not actually the toe. It's that large pad on the bottom of my foot right behind the big toe. So it's a big circular area, inch and a half, 2 inches in diameter. It's that pad that's sore. It's not the toe itself. At least
right.
That's the way it's.
Right, but so if you were to walk where your toe bends, right there.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that is where that joint and those sesamoid bones are. So they're right underneath that big pad.
Yeah.
Okay.
So,
gotcha.
So are you flat-footed?
Yes.
Okay. So So there are a number of things. I would suggest getting in to see somebody to look at the mechanics of your foot. The mechanics of your foot are fairly complicated. So if you are fairly flat-footed, what tends to happen is you roll over onto the inside of your foot, and instead of your weight rolling out the end of your big toe, you roll off the inside right by that ball. So if that mechanical problem is what's causing this, then there are different interventions that one would use. But it seems to me that you have a mechanical problem due to your foot posture. And so there are a number of sort of differential causes that have to get sorted through, and they're best done by an exam. Jill, what do you think?
I totally agree. And the other thing is your great toe, that MTP joint, metatarsophalangeal joint that we're talking about, impacts so much because you need a lot of mobility there for normal walking. And if you don't have it, then you start compensating, and you can compensate all the way up to your chain, all the way up your chain, and end up with knee pain or hip pain or low back pain. And if you want to maintain to be highly active, which we'd like you to do, we don't want that to happen. So I think getting to the root of this is a good idea.
Right. And part of that is, you know, Jill made a really good point. We really need you to maintain good mobility in that first MTP joint. If you're barefoot, you need 90 degrees of mobility there. And people who are flat-footed tend to roll off the inside of their big toe joint. And so as a result, they don't get that constant movement of that joint, and that joint gets stiff. So if it's not addressed over time, you will lose mobility there, and that has really long-term implications.
Good luck, Steve. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. Lori Tyne Brody is a physical therapist and athletic trainer at UW Health Spine Physical Therapy Clinic. And Jill Tyne Nissenbaum, associate professor in the Doctor of Physical Therapy program. I'm Larry Mueller. You are listening to the Ideas Network. Thanks for joining us today on the Ideas Network, taking a look at all kinds of physical therapy issues today with our two guests, Jill Tyne Nissenbaum and Lori Tyne Brody, both with the University of Wisconsin-Madison, UW Health. It's great to have them along, and join in, 800-642-1234, email at ideas@wpr.org. Amy, who'd called earlier having hip bursitis, had, I think it was one thing we didn't address with her. She wanted to see if, if she should have imaging done of the area of her hip. It was mentioned in the beginning, but we didn't get to it by the end of the conversation.
Yeah, so that's a great question. So I think I would start with going back to my physical therapist, trying some hip strengthening, screening the low back to make sure her symptoms are not coming from her low back, and treating her back before I'd go down the path of imaging. Imaging doesn't necessarily affect our course of care so much. There are many times that things will appear in imaging that are what we call incidental findings, and so they don't necessarily impact our course of care. So to expose yourself to imaging without it impacting your course of care probably isn't necessary at this point. She doesn't really have any red flags that concern me, so I would just go with care before I'd go down the course of imaging. Lori, what do you think?
Yeah, I agree. We can get sidetracked by imaging, so imaging, you are not your radiograph. You are not your MRI. So one of the studies we always go back to is when MRI was first developed, they did spine images on all these healthy, normal people to begin to understand spinal anatomy, and fully half of them had pathology in their spine but had no symptoms. So sometimes you see something on an image and you fixate on it and you say, that's the cause of my pain, and it can really lead you down the wrong path. So we get much more information from our history, our patient history and subjective report, and following that with a good focused clinical examination. We develop a hypothesis or a working theory. We treat like that, and if things aren't working out and it's not heading the direction we think it should, and then we will take the next step for imaging.
Laura from Appleton emailed with a question. She's wondering if there's anything she can do to repair a trigger finger. She says, of course, it's on her writing hand, which makes it difficult to grasp a pen. She wonders if trigger fingers go away, or is there something she will have to live with forever? If she needs to visit a doctor, what kind of doctor would she consult?
Yeah, so I can take this one because my husband had a trigger finger.
I was going to say, yeah.
And it was on his dominant hand as well, and it was his ring finger, which I believe is the most common one. So a couple of things. First of all, I would start with, if you can get in, it's helpful to see a hand surgeon. This is really their area of expertise. And you can get a corticosteroid injection there. I believe that they will do up to two. And he got some temporary relief from the corticosteroid injections, but he ultimately ended up having the trigger finger released. What happens is you build up a little bit of scar tissue on the tendon, and when it has to glide through a pulley that kind of holds the tendon in place, think of it as going through a bridge, so going through under a tunnel, like going through a tunnel under a bridge, and if you go under there and it kind of gets caught. So the steroid may help, or ultimately they may have to just debride the little bit of scar tissue. It's a very, very tiny incision, and my husband went back to work the next day.
Oh.
So it's a small procedure that can make you feel better. So I would see somebody for this because you don't have to live with it, and the interventions are pretty low risk, I guess, I would say.
There we go.
There you go.
Mary in Fort Atkinson, your turn. Hi, Mary.
Good morning. I have a quick question about dry needling. I am going to a physical therapist, and I've had a couple of sessions for tendonitis. And I just wondered what your thoughts were on dry needling.
So tendonitis for what?
Knee, inside of the knee.
Okay, all right. And thoughts on dry needling. Okay, so did you discuss this with your physical therapist? Like, what are they going to dry needle?
Well, she told me if I wasn't familiar with the term that I should Google it, which I did. Mm-hmm. And then she said, what do you have to lose? Let's try it. And I'm like, okay. So the person was good. Kind of went downhill, and I've had the second one, and I haven't had much relief from that. So I just wondered your thoughts on that.
So what is she needling? Is she needling your quadriceps muscle, or tell me a little bit about what specifically is getting needled? Do you know?
The top of my thigh.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. For the inside of my knee, right?
Okay. Okay.
I don't, and I have an option. I can either watch or not, and it doesn't bother me to watch, but I don't.
I totally understand. It's great that she gives you that option. So for the listeners, dry needling uses a solid needle, so there's nothing injected in the needle. They're very similar to acupuncture needles. The procedure is not acupuncture. I want to make sure that people understand that difference. What a physical therapist can do is use that acupuncture-like needle to hit a trigger point that lives in the muscle to kind of create a twitch response to get that muscle to relax or loosen up. So how dry needling is often used is if you have a muscle imbalance where you're overusing a particular muscle, you can perform dry needling on that muscle to kind of get the muscle to relax, to retrain your muscles to work a little bit more in balance. So that's the way trigger point dry needling is commonly used by physical therapists. Thoughts on it. So it is such a new technique in the hands of physical therapists that there isn't a lot of evidence providing a clear path for us right now. So there's not hard concrete evidence saying absolutely it will improve outcomes. But likewise, there's not a lot of hard evidence saying that it's ineffective. So having said that, moving forward, to use it as an adjunct to a well-designed exercise program is a good option. I would not use it in isolation. I would not say that of all the components of your rehabilitation program that that is the change agent. The most important part of your rehabilitation program is really therapeutic exercise. So the flexibility exercises and or strengthening exercises that your PT has provided you are probably going to be the bread and butter or the meat and potatoes, the mainstay of your rehab program.
Absolutely. So it's like, ultrasound or one of the many other tools that physical therapists use. It's an adjunct to create an environment where the exercise can potentially take hold and help start the healing process. So it's only one piece of an intervention program.
Exactly. So I wouldn't stop or abandon my exercises. I would do it in addition to my exercises and see if it makes a change.
All right. There you go, Mary. Thank you. JD in Dodgeville, your turn. Hi, JD.
Hello. How are you?
Good. Appreciate the call. What's on your mind?
So I'm having an issue with the inside of my left foot. There's I think a bone apparently sticking out, and it's only on my left foot. My right foot is completely fine, but if you take your hand and run it along the inside, there's a noticeable bump there, and it's not a sharp pain, but it's just tender all the time. And I've been to a chiropractor to see if maybe they can do some sort of adjustment or whatever, and they weren't able to do anything. So I'm not real certain what I should do.
Do you know how long has this been going on? Do you have any idea what started the pain?
Honestly, I don't know what started it. As far as how long, I would say probably a year.
Oh my. Okay.
So, did they tell you what bone it is? Is it close to your ankle bone, or is it more down by the ball of your foot?
Nope. So it's kind of like where the arch kind of peaks right below your ankle bone.
Yeah.
Navicular.
It is navicular. Yeah.
Navicular. I wonder if he's got, if he pronates more, has a little bit of flat foot more on that side. And if
Or he could have some posterior tib tendinopathy.
Yes. So a couple options for you. What Lori and I are talking about is you could have a joint there, it's called your mid-tarsal joint, where if your ankle joint is really tight or stiff, you will overuse that midfoot, and it could cause some bony pain, or it could cause some tendinopathy or overuse in your posterior tibialis tendon. Do you want to explain that one a little bit, Lori?
So the if you think of your arch as like the mortise or the or a bridge, an arched bridge, you have a tendon that runs down on the inside of your ankle and around your ankle bone, and then it attaches really to the top point of that arch, and it helps hold it up, if you will. So if that mid-tarsal joint that Jill talked about is a little too mobile, and it could be primarily mobile or it could be secondarily mobile because your ankle is stiff, as she said. So you got to get your mobility somewhere. So if one joint is stiff, you'll get excessive motion at the adjacent joint. So that tendon may be having to work overtime to hold up the arch of the bridge. So I would get in and see somebody and have them do an exam because there's a number of different factors at play here. It could be a leg length difference that's precipitating it. So sorting that out is going to be key.
And a physical therapist or a doctor?
Yep. Yeah, I thought physical therapist. Yeah, it's okay. Been a year. It's been a year. If it was going to get better on its own, it would have.
Thanks very much for calling, JD. Appreciate it. Lori Tyne-Brody and Jill Tyne-Nissenbaum, our guests today. Looking forward to the rest of the program. They'll be with us right up till 12:30. We'll take a look at the news and weather, find out what else is in store for us, and then we'll be back with our guests. You stay with us. I'm Larry Mueller for the Ideas Network. Great to have you along on the Ideas Network. I'm Larry Mueller, and we're taking a look at all kinds of physical therapy issues with our two guests, Jill Tyne-Nissenbaum, Associate Professor in the Doctor of Physical Therapy program at UW-Madison, and Lori Tyne-Brody. Lori's a physical therapist and an athletic trainer at UW Health Spine Physical Therapy Clinic. Here to answer your questions about physical therapy. And our lines are completely full, so I think we'll go right back to the phones and to Kathy in Milwaukee. Kathy, thanks for waiting. What's on your mind?
Hi. I have a foot issue as well. A couple of months ago, I took a walk outside. I did about a mile around the neighborhood. Came home and decided to just take a little rest. And I laid on one of my benches that I have in my rear yard for about 20 minutes or so. When I got up, I couldn't walk on my right foot. And I've had lots of pain since then. I contacted my regular physician, and she sent me some exercises to do, some strengthening. Or no, I think it was stretching exercises. And those didn't seem to help very much. To make a long story short, then I went to see my orthopedic doctor, and he took an x-ray and said it looked like I have either arthritis or a stress fracture. He wasn't exactly sure. But I'm having a lot of pain. I can't really walk well on it. I'm using a cane as best I can. So I need some advice.
Oh, yeah. Sure. So, where in your foot is the pain?
The pain is on the outside of my right foot, the knobby bone.
Yep. Jones fracture.
Yeah, it sounds like a Jones fracture.
Jones fracture. Okay.
Did they use that term, a potential Jones fracture, with you?
No.
Okay.
No, it's a stress fracture. Okay.
It could be a Jones fracture, a stress fracture. It could be a small avulsion fracture, although that's kind of doubtful.
Right.
Did they give you a walking boot or anything like that to kind of support your foot?
No. No. My regular doctor said if I had a boot with kind of a high ankle, I should try using that, and I have. But I don't think it's as effective as one that is designed, of course.
Yeah, I think you need a medical boot of some sort, or it needs to be immobilized. This is not being managed. I think we need to get more management in here, don't you think, Lori?
Right. Well,
So let's just start with some of the stress fractures in it's your fifth metatarsal. Some stress fractures, depending upon the location, will heal. Some stress fractures have a really high rate of non-union. So my guess is if you saw an orthopedic surgeon, that person would know this. So my guess is since they didn't insist that you go in a boot, I'm going to stop there, because even if it was not a Jones fracture, just an ordinary stress fracture, you still should have been immobilized some.
Right.
So okay. That's what confuses me. So if your primary had made that call and was unsure about that, that'd be one level. But the orthopedic should be clear on that. But typically these are immobilized. It's been 2 months and you're still having pain. Have you gone back to the orthopedic?
No, I have not.
Then it's time to do that,
exactly.
I would say.
Yeah, I think they probably assumed that no news is good news and that you're doing okay, and that is indeed not the case. So I think it's time to alert them that, hey, I'm not getting any better. This has significantly impacted my quality of life. I have pain. I'm limping. And we don't want that to happen because then you can hurt other joints.
Yeah.
So I think it's definitely time.
Knee pain, back pain, whatever.
Yeah. So it's time to alert them that you're not improving as expected.
Yeah, and they may want to re-image it because sometimes that stress fracture doesn't show up in an early radiograph, but it shows up later.
Right.
So they may want to re-image it. And so I'm going to throw this into, if they do give you a boot, it makes you uneven. And that's one of the things that, as a physical therapist, annoys me, because I see people walking around uneven, and there's something called an even up, and you can buy them online, and it's just something that it straps onto your other shoe to level you out. And I think that's really important. Otherwise, people end up with hip pain, knee pain, back pain, because they walk around literally for weeks in this uneven scenario. So, I'd head back there and have that looked at again, because there's something missing in this puzzle.
Yep. Good luck, Kathy.
Yep. If they give you a boot, ask for an even up.
And thank you again for calling. Joan in Green Bay, it's your turn. Hi, Joan.
Hello. I have sharp pains. It started out in one foot on the inside of my foot, like from the big toe joint, and then goes up from there. It feels like it might be nerve pain or something. It wakes me up during the night. Now I have it on both feet. Is that nerve pain, or what might that be?
So when you say it goes up, do you mean it goes up towards your ankle, like up your leg?
No, it only, if you started at my big toe joint, maybe I feel it for like 3 inches up. It's not an instep, it's higher up on my foot, and it's the same on both feet now.
When you say higher up, I'm not sure what you mean by higher up.
Okay, more like on the top, but towards the inside.
Okay.
You know, whatever stretches from the big toe joint up more towards the middle of the foot. I'd say it doesn't get to my ankle.
Okay. So it sounds like it's kind of along her first ray, exactly. Either on the medial side or up on the superior anterior aspect of her foot. So it sounds like it's first ray-ish.
Does it hurt any other time besides at night?
I've started walking quite a lot more, and I think it's correlated with that. Sometimes I can feel it when I'm walking, not all the time. I mean, I've tried different shoes and to see if that had an impact. It doesn't seem like ibuprofen has any impact on the pain at night.
And when you say pain at night, can you describe the pain? Is it sharp, stabby, tingly, numby?
Sharp, stabby. Just like take your breath away, sharp, stabby.
Okay. Nerve pain isn't usually sharp and stabby.
Right.
Okay.
Yeah, mechanical pain. So usually when people have neuropathy, neurologic symptoms. So the two biggest things in your feet would be neuropathy, peripheral neuropathy, or maybe something called tarsal tunnel.
That was my first thought too, yeah.
Yeah.
But it doesn't sound like that.
It doesn't sound like that. It sounds like it could be more mechanical related to your big toe joint, which we have talked about a great deal, and that would correlate well with your increase in your walking. Do you want to go, Jill?
Yeah, absolutely. So this is, you know, one of the things that we are seeing as a consequence of COVID. One of the things that people can get out and do for exercise is walk. And if you've had an increase in your walking and you could get a little bit of like an overload type injury at that joint. So we're talking about kind of your first toe and then kind of the whole line that goes with it. I hear you say you've tried different shoes, which is a wonderful strategy. That's a really good thing to do. It doesn't sound like that has helped you. So I would definitely suggest getting in to see a physical therapist. This also sounds like it's mechanical in nature. And your physical therapist may recommend some certain flexibility or mobilization to do to help with this, and or can recommend shoe wear, as well as surface that they would recommend that you do your walking on. So if you're walking on hard concrete, that can be really hard on your joints. So they may recommend a high school track or a trail, something along those lines. So I think it's time to get in and see somebody because we want to keep you walking.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Good luck,
Joan. Absolutely.
Julie.
Yep.
Thanks for calling. Rana in Rice Lake, we'll turn to you now. Hi, Rana.
Hi, good afternoon. So I'm 57, and I have two artificial knees and an artificial hip. My artificial hip came to me about 5 years ago, and after I had that replaced, and I should add in, I do my physical therapy before and after either of those surgery, plus what, I mean, I do as much as I can stand. I did. So after the hip surgery, I had just a small amount of pain and that never really went away. And I would occasionally get a cortisone shot, and that would help. Now I'm getting considerable amount of hip pain. So I went back. I figured I needed some physical therapy to just get some real specific muscles tightened again.
Mm-hmm.
And they did an X-ray, and the PA, when he looked at my X-ray, said, "Oh my gosh, your left hip is terrible. Are you getting your left hip replaced?" And I was there to talk about my right hip, and my left hip doesn't give me any pain at all. So now I'm thinking, what is wrong with me? Am I supposed to have this? When my knees went, I mean, I had pain, but it was. Do I have a high pain threshold? I mean,
thank you for that call, because
exactly.
You have just validated what we said earlier, and that is people are not their radiograph.
You're more than your X-rays.
Yeah.
Yeah,
exactly. You can have what look like horrible X-rays and no pain, and you can have lots of pain and pristine radiographs. So there isn't a direct one-to-one correlation between radiograph images and symptoms. So are you going back to PT for your right hip?
Yes, I started PT about a week ago, and okay. I'll be going back just to check in
with George every week
and icing, and I think I'll get it'll get stronger.
Right.
But meantime, in the back of my head, I'm just really wish that guy would never have said that.
What we can tell you is, okay, you have some arthritic changes radiographically, but they're not manifesting clinically. But having said that, it would probably be a good idea to make sure that you do maintain your flexibility and your strength in that left hip. So if your PT can give you some preventative exercises for that hip, I would encourage you to do that. You had mentioned that you did prehab before your knee replacements and hip replacements. So I would definitely get on that wagon and make sure that you do some good strengthening exercises for that left hip.
Absolutely. And it may be that you are changing the way you walk and move and overloading your right hip, because you may on some level be protecting your left hip. So
right.
Just keep that in mind.
There you go, Rana. Thank you very much for calling. Let's go to Roger in Grandford, Wisconsin. Hi, Roger.
Hi, how you doing?
Good. Appreciate the call.
I got a question for the gals there. When I go to bed at night, I've got a foot issue. I'm a side sleeper. I sleep on my left side ever. And when I lay down on the bed, I've got to put something. I got to take my right foot and put underneath my left ankle, because if my ankle bends, like when you lay on the mattress, if it bends to the inside, it just drives me nuts. It's like just on fire within a matter of like seconds. And I don't understand, or otherwise I got to put my leg over and hang my foot off the side of the bed so my ankle is straight.
Mm-hmm.
It never goes away. It don't ever stop. The only other thing was, if I look back, if I've got blankets on the ends of my toe, on the ends of my feet, I pull them out. Tuck in.
So we've heard this before, that there's people who, you know, the tucked in tight blankets at the end of the bed can cause your foot to kind of go into an extreme range of motion that's mm-hmm. uncomfortable for you. So we've talked to a lot of people who untuck their blankets, which is a fine strategy. It sounds to me, Lori, correct me if I'm wrong, but that he's, without putting his right foot under his left foot, it's putting him in inversion, would you say? That's what I'm thinking.
Because he's lying on his left side.
Right. So it sounds to me like he's putting his right foot
underneath
his ankle to avoid going into
inversion.
Inversion. Yeah. So I'm wondering if it's his peroneal nerve that's getting irritated. That'd be my guess, because he's going to be in plantar flexion.
Yeah. And it's only the one side? It's only the left side?
He always sleeps on his left side, yeah.
Right, but I wonder if he slept on his right side, if he'd have the symptoms on the right.
Well.
So, I mean, I'm just wondering about just a general peripheral neuropathy.
That could be as well.
Or even back on a tarsal tunnel. Mm. So, have you seen your doctor?
I've seen him a few times about other issues. I've got the neuropathy, the pins and needles with my feet, and my legs constant every day.
Okay,
it just burns.
I feel like
I'm being stung in bees.
Yeah. Hmm. So those are peripheral neuropathy symptoms.
Yeah, that sounds neuropathic to me. Yep.
Yeah, and so my guess is that it's just worse at night. So you get in a certain position. And, you know, when you lie down at night and you're not moving, then symptoms seem to just creep up and worsen at night, because you don't have that movement to keep a good blood flow. Do you have diabetes?
No, I don't. But they keep trying to tell me that, oh, you're diabetic now. I was just recently had been down in St. Regents. I ended up in a coma for 3 weeks, and they come through and I'm like, can you check me up for whatever for diabetes? Because they keep telling me that, well, now you have onset diabetes.
Yeah.
And my blood sugar is like constantly 100, 110,
okay.
112,
right.
you
okay.
know, which I don't see that's a problem.
Yeah, no, that doesn't sound like a problem. So you can have what we call idiopathic peripheral neuropathy, and those are people who develop these pins and needles in their legs, and nobody knows why.
Right.
So my guess is that there's something about the position of your foot that's putting stress on a nerve, and Jill's number one suspect is the peroneal nerve. It's a nerve that runs on the outside of your ankle, around your ankle bone. So if your ankle gets turned in, it puts that nerve on stretch, and it may just really fire off that nerve. So, you know, that positioning seems to help. I don't know if any kind of a night splint that held your ankle in a neutral position would help. That's another thing you could try. But it sounds like your bigger issue is peripheral neuropathy, and if your doctor is not treating you for symptoms of peripheral neuropathy, that would be my next stop.
Right.
There you go. Good luck, Roger. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate it. Let's go to Kay in Wausau. Hi, Kay.
Oh, this is one of the best programs that I know of, so thank you for that.
Thank you.
Thank you, Kay.
What happened was, I was hoeing in the garden, and I haven't hoed for a while, and it's my right hand the next day I woke up and I had carpal tunnel surgery on that hand in the past, and it hurt in the middle of my hand and my fingers, especially my fourth finger, my ring finger. Can hardly close my hand to a fist. Very painful. And I have had trigger finger type things in the past, cortisone treatments, and that did help.
So yeah. did the symptoms feel like the same symptoms you had previously with your carpal tunnel?
No.
Okay.
No, this is different. It just aches, and I have trouble bending my fingers, especially my ring finger now.
Does your hand feel swollen? I'm just wondering if she just gets some... No? Okay.
No, it's just... Is this all due to arthritis? Oh, and I did take extra strength Tylenol. That did help me some.
Yeah. I mean, it could be arthritis. You know, I mean, that would be the primary suspect. It sounds like you have some other issue, some connective tissue issues with your carpal tunnel and with your trigger finger. So it certainly could be if you were using a tool where you were gripping for a long time, could have just created some inflammation in all those joints. Are you able to open your hand fully now?
Yeah, I can, but it hurts. The more I exercise it and open and close it, it seems to help. It seems to get a little bit better.
Yeah, that sounds arthritic-y to me. Mm-hmm. I wonder if just, you know, aggressive gripping with that hoe, especially if your wrist was in kind of an awkward position, plus your history of carpal tunnel, plus your history of trigger finger, that's a lot of history on one hand, your dominant hand probably. If that was just, you know, like a sudden overuse, I mean, maybe it's the equivalent of somebody not training for a marathon and running a marathon on their knee in your hand.
Right.
Probably what we're dealing with.
I'd probably just keep an eye on it, and it should resolve over the next few days. You know, continuing to take maybe some medication, maybe some warm water. You know, what we typically do is, if you can think of doing the dishes, you know, that sort of movement of the hand in warm water, squeezing a sponge, moving your wrist and fingers around in different ways tends to be a good activity to help with that.
Right.
And if things do not resolve, if you're still continuing to have symptoms, I would check in with the person who dealt with your trigger finger. That would be the place that I would go next.
Yeah.
There you go. Thank you very much. Good luck, Kate. Appreciate your call very much. And appreciate Jill and Lori as well. Jill and Lori, thank you so much for being with us today. Really appreciate it.
Happy to be here. It was great. It was a lot of fun. A lot of great questions. A lot of good callers and great questions.
And they will be back on July 20th. Jill Tyne-Nissenbaum, Associate Professor in the Doctor of Physical Therapy Program at UW, and Lori Tyne-Brody, Physical Therapist and an Athletic Trainer at UW Health Spine Physical Therapy Clinic. Taking a look tomorrow on the show, we'll talk to Wisconsin author Jennifer Cheverini about her latest book. It's called Mrs. Lincoln's Sisters. I just finished it last night. It's a fun read for sure. So looking forward to that. You can read some tips from our recent shows on our blog. We just put up 5 ways to identify some Wisconsin owls. Just go to wpr.org/Larry to find it. Thanks for listening. Stay with us. Lots in store.